The single most important factor for improving test scores was the longevity of a principal, a school leader.
Congress looks for ways to improve education outcomes for Alaska Native and American Indian students. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 18th of June. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, elders in the YK Delta won't have to go to the big city for long-term care.
We've tried to incorporate cultural aspects of our lifestyle here.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
A Juneau woman admitted to the hospital earlier this week with symptoms of paralytic shellfish poisoning has died. The woman reportedly ate cockles harvested from Auk Bay on Monday and was later admitted to Bartlett Regional Hospital with PSP symptoms. Bartlett spokesman Jim Strader was unable to provide additional information about the woman or her previous medical history. Department of Health spokesman Greg Wilkinson says the state won't be conducting its own autopsy, but nothing about the woman's death suggests it was from anything other than PSP.
Cockles taken as samples from the beach, from the Point Luisa Beach, tested extremely high for paralytic shellfish poison, actually about 30 times as toxic as what it would be considered edible. An action level is considered to be greater than or equal to 80 parts per million. These were tested at 2,044 parts per million, so very high.
Three more cases of PSP were reported in Kodiak this week, though there haven't been any deaths in those instances. Wilkinson says the last confirmed PSP death in Alaska was in 1997. The State Department of Environmental Conservation is posting signs on Alaska beaches warning about the risk of harvesting shellfish for personal use. U.S. senators say the Bush-era No Child Left Behind education law failed Alaska Natives and Native Americans. The Senate Indian Affairs Committee took testimony yesterday on how the country's Education Act should be rewritten to better serve Native students. As part of our series on Alaska Native education, APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
As the Obama administration and Congress revise the national education policy, they're considering how it's affected Native children and young adults. Democratic Senator Tom Udall of New Mexico.
Did the No Child Left Behind Act leave Indian students behind? I don't think there's any doubt in terms of how we answer that question. It has left Native American students behind.
The president-elect of the National Indian Education Association, Mary Jane Oatman Wackwack, says No Child Left Behind did do one useful thing, provide hard data on how the public education system underserves Native children.
Shining the light on those dark corners where our Indian children were hiding and where, through a lack of desegregated data, they were allowed to hide.
Oatman Wackwack and others testified about what they'd like to see improved in the National Education Policy, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, or ESEA. Keith Moore is the new director of the Interior Department's Bureau of Indian Education.
The reauthorization of ESEA represents a unique opportunity, I believe, for us to ensure that this act works for American Indian and Alaska Native communities across this country.
Moore says the Education Act should support the self-determination of tribes and place higher value on tribal culture, history, and language than No Child Left Behind did.
That is a part that we really feel has been left out. The respect paid to our tribal cultures, our languages, the unique needs that our students need inside standards, the values that we have as a people, all of those things are missing right now in NCLB and are vital for our students feeling valued and welcomed and comfortable in school systems.
Members of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee are critical of some aspects of the Obama administration's proposals. Senator Lisa Murkowski has repeatedly raised the concern that one solution for dealing with failing schools is firing the principal and much of the teaching staff. She says rural educators instead need to be supported and given incentives like job security and good housing.
We're going to have situations where it's children in our villages up north, it's children in our on our reservations, where we're not going to be able to get those key administrators, those key teachers to come in.
Education policy professor David Bolio runs an Institute of American Indian Education at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. He agreed with Murkowski that having consistent leadership in schools is fundamental.
The single most important factor for improving test scores was the longevity of a principal, a school leader, who had a vision and a plan for the education of that school community.
The Obama administration's official from the education department to testify was Charlie Rose, the general counsel. He says they do recognize the challenges their proposals present, like getting rid of teachers and principals, especially in rural Alaska.
But I also want to say that sometimes, as difficult as it may be, and I'm also speaking from my experience as a school board lawyer, a change in leadership is necessary.
Valuing Native students by giving them the best tools and teachers was repeatedly cited as something that should be a top priority, both for the federal government and tribes. The panel heard from a 19-year-old college sophomore who struggled in public schools before she found success at a charter school geared to Native American students. Mariah Bowers is Alaska Native and was adopted by a family belonging to the Native American Yurok Tribe of California. She says at the tribe's charter school, she found support, not just from teachers and peers, but from the community.
Having the elders come into the school and sit there was really motivating, and one of the elders who came most of the days was actually my great uncle, and he was always telling me, you know, to behave and to, you know, not always look at the boys and to just focus on school. And so having him sit there and be behind me, it kind of made him seem like he was always standing behind me, supporting me.
The Indian Affairs Committee's top senator, Byron Dorgan of North Dakota, asked Mariah Bowers if she feels like she can now succeed.
There's no doubt in your mind you can be what you want to be. Is that correct?
Yep. I could be whatever I want to be as long as I try, work hard, do the homework, go to class.
Good for you. You know, the only limits on you and your life are the limits you put on yourself. And there are a lot of barriers, but I'm talking about limits now. You can get over the barriers.
The question for the senators and the Obama administration is how to break down more of the barriers currently before young Alaska Natives and Native Americans so they can have a better shot at success. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
A 10-year dream to have a place for aging seniors to live in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta is becoming a reality. The state has funded a long-term care facility for the second year in a row in the capital budget, totaling over $16 million. Now the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation in Bethel plans to start the building process. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
The facility will be a place for the elderly and people with disabilities to live and get 24-hour assistance. To get that right now, they have to move out of the YK Delta, often to Anchorage. That has caused many hardships for families and the seniors getting care. Seniors who have eaten subsistence foods almost exclusively are eating foreign city food. And oftentimes, they never see their families again because it's too expensive for them to travel, especially from remote villages. Director of Senior Services, Liz Lee.
For those that could coordinate, they could schedule a trip to Anchorage, but then you're dealing with the costs of airfare, lodging, meals, transportation. With the facility in Bethel, that'll be much easier for many families.
YKHC created a building design plan back in 2003. It will be 16,000 square feet and have 18 beds. It will have 24-hour staff, certified nurse assistants mostly. But the plans are to eventually make it into a nursing home.
The building is going to be designed for the care needs of a nursing home.
Greg McIntyre is the vice president for support services at the Health Corporation. A nursing home would require 24-hour nursing staff, which McIntyre says is too expensive right now.
When you start thinking about three shifts of nursing staff having to be there, that certainly increases the cost of running the facility. So we're not quite sure if that's financially sustainable, so we're probably going to start out with assisted living and work our way into this.
As it is, the Health Corporation will be losing about $1.5 million a year just to operate the long-term care facility. But it's something that the board accepts. Again, Liz Lee.
Operational losses are a concern. We've been very upfront from the very beginning. And so we're doing some work now to try to reduce that?
That includes working for better reimbursement rates for people receiving care in the bush.
In most circumstances, what it costs to provide service out here isn't reimbursed at 100%, so YKHC has to subsidize the difference.
The health corporation doesn't know where exactly they'll build the facility. They have a couple of options in mind. They do know that they hope to start construction this coming winter. Again, Greg McIntyre.
We'll do code upgrades, site adaptation to whatever site that we're going to choose, which is most economical probably, and then hopefully get piling started this winter.
The main part of the construction would happen after the majority of supplies were barged in next summer. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, drilling for ice cores on the glaciers near Denali.
You can see in the chemistry course changes as a result of changing policies from Clean Air Acts and whatnot.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
An upcoming special election in Houston has been canceled because Houston Mayor Roger Purcell has handed in his resignation. The election would have determined whether or not voters wanted to recall Purcell. Thursday night, the Houston City Council accepted the resignation in a 4-2 vote. Purcell had sent a letter to the panel but did not appear in person. Purcell raised the ire of some city residents when he drove a city police car to Fairbanks and allegedly used the vehicle's emergency lights on the way. That issue resulted in a recall application being filed against him and a special election being scheduled for June 22nd. Purcell will remain on the city council, which elects one of its own as city mayor. The mayor is responsible for the day-to-day operations of the city and runs council meetings. Purcell's city council term expires in October. Purcell was elected to the city council in 2007. He could not be reached for comment today. Houston is a city of around 1,000 people located about 60 miles northwest of Anchorage. Nome Mayor Denise Michaels has withdrawn her name from the race for lieutenant governor. She was running in the Democratic primary. Michaels says she found running for statewide office from Nome is too big a task when combined with her mayoral position and her job as transportation director for the Cowrock Corporation. She says she faced a very busy travel schedule in the next few weeks with her current positions, and she was running into too many conflicts with political activity.
Realizing I wouldn't be able to do that, that's when I had to sit down and be real and look at I'm not going to drop the commitments that I've already made, for running for the lieutenant governor's position. So those kind of issues is what I had to deal with.
Michaels' withdrawal leaves three other candidates on the primary ballot, Diane Benson, Lynette Moreno-Hintz, and Jack Powers, all from Anchorage. Researchers with the University of Maine, Dartmouth College, and the University of New Hampshire recently mingled with climbers at Mount McKinley's Cahiltna Base Camp. Their mission was not to reach the summit of Denali, but to find ice old enough to reveal climate history. Reporter Dina Hecker bought up with the scientists at base camp and has this story.
A team of scientists recently completed their third season searching for the perfect spot to collect ice core samples that would allow them a good look at how climate has changed in 1,000 years. Seth Campbell, a graduate student with the University of Maine and also a full-time environmental engineer with the Army Corps of Engineers, was part of the expedition and explains.
Our original advisor's goal was to find a new site to drill an ice core to look at the past 1,000 years of climate history.
The researchers have come to the Alaska Range to look for just that spot on Mount Russell, Kehutna Glacier, and this year on Mount Hunter. The scientists still have to wait for the final results, but are pretty hopeful that they found what they are looking for on Kehutna Pass and Mount Hunter. This project actually ballooned from work done in the St. Elias mountain range, where 15,000 years of data were found in a 300-meter core. Researchers found that ice cores not only contain climate change information, but also give us a clue about the migration of pollution.
There's a significant amount of pollution being transported across from Eurasia all the way to Alaska, lead pollution being an example of one of them. And the idea was to try to extrapolate what we have for information from the coastal mountain range suite more inland to see how far inland this pollution is coming. So it's not only a climate change debate, but it's also looking at pollution transport, and it becomes kind of a political debate as well in terms of, hey, you know, other countries are polluting U.S. soil in a way.
They also see the effects of stricter environmental laws in the ice.
You can see in the chemistry course changes as a result of changing policies from clean air acts and whatnot. We see cleaner ice nowadays, which is good. So we're just trying to get an idea of scope of how much change has occurred in climate, which we can get from the ice core, as well as the pollution record.
The research is funded by the National Science Foundation and also the Park Service for their interest in studying receding glaciers. But what's in it for those of us who are not science buffs?
The average person can benefit from our research just by having a general idea that climate change is happening, you know, overall. And basically, you know, one of the reasons we look at ice cores is it maintains a spectacular long-term record of climate change. There's certainly changes that are occurring, and I think it's just important for people to be aware of that and to be ready for that. You know, I don't think it's necessarily a horrible thing. It can alter political structures, and it can alter basically everyone's experience in life. But, you know, it's just something to be aware of.
Reporting from Talkeetna, this is Deanna Hecker.
The state is limiting the harvest of Copper River king salmon. Chitna dip netters will no longer be able to keep kings as of Monday. State management biologist Mark Somerville says the Department of Fish and Game is following up earlier measures taken to decrease the commercial Chinook catch downstream with upriver harvest reductions.
We feel the commercial fishery's has been cut back, and they're probably harvesting at this point maybe 30% of their average. We've looked at the numbers in the upper river here, and the dip net fishery has been able to harvest probably about 50% is what we figure by about this time. So we're closing it off at this point because we see a downturn in the numbers.
The annual limit for Copper River System sport fishers is being ratcheted back from 4 kings to 2. Somerville says the measures reflect a weakening run, as indicated by a declining count at downriver fish sampling wheels operated by the native village of Eak.
Those wheels right now, they're at their lowest cumulative harvest or cumulative catch that we've seen since they've been doing the project. They were tracking higher than last year, which was the previous low, but they're now dropping off.
The much larger Copper River sockeye return is also tracking below projection, but so far daily passage totals have been sufficient and have not warranted fishing restrictions.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. Crane accidents are on the rise around the nation. Making sure that crane operators are properly trained and certified is crucial to minimizing accidents in Alaska. Equally important is ensuring that riggers and signal persons are adequately trained. More information is available at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
The Regulatory Commission of Alaska says it won't allow Juneau's electrical utility to raise rates 20% this month. The commission yesterday denied Alaska Electric Light and Power's request for the interim increase while it studies a permanent 24% hike, a process that could take 15 months. The size of the interim rate increase, 20%, caught the agency's attention, according to spokeswoman Grace Salazar. At an average household use of 750 kilowatts a month, it would amount to about $14 more a month in electricity charges during the winter.
The RCA is concerned that ALMP has not adequately addressed the rate shock to consumers resulting from 20% or higher rate increase.
In the order, the commission also says it needs more proof AELNP should be allowed to recover the costs of its new Lake Dorothy hydroelectric project through an interim rate. Scott Willis is AELNP Vice President of Generation. He says he's surprised the agency denied the interim rate hike, which would have taken effect today.
And I guess rather than a denial, we should look at that as being a temporary postponement. The RCA has asked for additional information to be assured that the interim rate request is justified. We're going to provide the information they request because we feel that there is a good justification for both the interim and the permanent rate that we've requested.
Lake Dorothy started producing power in August of 2009. Though it is temporarily offline for repairs, it has been producing about 20% of Juneau's power. Alaska farmers facing high transportation costs can get a little financial help from the federal government. A program was set up for Alaska and Hawaii food producers 2 years ago, but Congress waited until this year to fund it. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
Farmers are already pretty good at keeping financial records, and now those records could be worth some money in Alaska, Hawaii, and U.S. territories. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has $2.6 million for reimbursing the higher transportation costs of food producers located outside the contiguous states. The eligibility period is this current fiscal year, and they'll take applications this August. According to Alaska Farm Service Agency head Danny Constantin, all farmers have to do is provide documentation of those costs.
They will compile a list of all of their expenses for the year. We'll look at all that, and based on the COLA, based on the cost of living adjustment that we have in Alaska, we will pay a small percentage of those costs. We will pay about a 25% portion of those transportation costs, and that way kind of, you know, level the playing field.
The costs can include the higher price of fuel Alaskan producers have to pay to get a product to market, as well as the additional cost of agricultural supplies like equipment and fertilizer that have to be shipped in. Ann Constantin says the USDA has a pretty broad definition of farming when it comes to Alaska.
A farmer or a producer or a greenhouse operator or a peony producer or even a shellfish grower who's considered, we consider farmers.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says the aim of the program is to reduce the cost to producers, which will hopefully allow them to charge lower prices so that locally produced food can more easily compete with food that's shipped in. But the funds are limited, which potentially could dilute the subsidy. Constantin says they have set up a short application window of just over a month, limited the program to small producers, and limited the total amount of any one award under the program.
We've put a cap on any one farmer, and they can only get a maximum of $8,000 payment. So hopefully there won't be some farmers in Hawaii that, you know, blow the whole program out of the water.
Secretary Vilsack visited Alaska agricultural facilities, including a small farm in Bethel, last year. The program's officially known as the Reimbursement Transportation Cost Payment Program for Geographically Disadvantaged Farmers and Ranchers. Farmers and ranchers can find out more from USDA offices in Palmer and Delta. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Mountain rescue teams from across the United States are in Juneau this week for the 51st Annual Mountain Rescue Association Conference. It includes classroom and field exercises designed to improve rescue skills and teach participants about the latest in gear and technology. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Juneau Mountain Rescue President Carl Bosler has been on a lot of missions over the years, but one that stuck with him happened in 1999 when three tourist helicopters crashed on Herbert Glacier. In a blowing snowstorm at dusk, the Coast Guard flew JMR up to the side of the ice field and let them go to work.
I was in the front, and we were kind of swapping off, you know, taking the lead there, and I thought I saw a glimmer of a light.
It turned out to be a pen light held by one of the tourists waiting to be rescued, and it helped guide JMR to the wrecked helicopters. Bosler says the most serious injury was a broken ankle, and after waiting out the storm overnight, the Coast Guard was able to come pick everyone up in the morning.
Got all the tourists off the ice field, and happy ending.
They're not all happy endings, but Bosler says the ones that are make it worthwhile. The Mountain Rescue Association is mostly made up of volunteer teams that go through rigorous training to be accredited by the MRA. Other member teams are paid professionals in the law enforcement and search and rescue fields. The annual MRA conference allows teams to network with groups from around the country and brush up on skills and techniques.
This is a great opportunity. For one, we get to see other Mountain Rescue Association colleagues from other teams, California, Colorado, Idaho, Portland, Washington State, and we all get to come together and share our skills, and if there are new skills that are being developed, then get to share those as well.
Juneau Mountain Rescue went on 16 missions in 2009. 14 of those involved a search, while the other two were rescues in which the team knew the location of the missing parties beforehand. By comparison, some of the other teams at this year's conference average more than 100 missions in a year. Juanita Smith is with Santa Barbara County Mountain Rescue in Southern California, which last year received more than 120 calls.
We have a lot of dehydration. We have trails where there's different forks that go a variety of ways, and people who think they know where they're going don't. So we have a lot of lost hikers. We also respond to rescues, which include cars over the sides, body recoveries, and those types of things.
While terrain and situations vary from one part of the country to another, Smith says techniques are pretty much the same everywhere. And it's important to keep up on skills she doesn't always use, like practicing glacier rescues, because you never know when you might get a call.
We could have something here. One of the mountain rescue conferences we were at, they actually did have a call where a bunch of people got together and helped. It was actually one of the conference attendees that was injured. But, you know, we all just used our skill and got him out. And, you know, so who knows?
Besides Juneau, there's also Sitka Mountain Rescue and Alaska Mountain Rescue Group in Anchorage. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Deanna Hecker in Talkeetna, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by your local public radio station.
If you've been through a lot of bad things and you feel like everyone would be better off without you, suicide isn't the answer. You're not alone. You have people who love you, and there is help. Call the Alaska Care Line at 1-877-266-HELP. Call, share, and live. If you're thinking about suicide, call for help at 1-877-266-HELP. This message sponsored by the Mindy Schloss Memorial Fund and the State of Alaska.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.